The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Hello, I'm Jack Wilson. Welcome to the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. Welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad you're here with me. It's Thanksgiving week here in the States, and I am very thankful, as always, thankful for my family, thankful for literature, and thankful that you have chosen to spend a little time with me. I'm thankful for my recovering health, which is why we missed a week. My apologies for that. We'll try to make it up in the future. We have a draft coming up soon, and a Mike Palindrome solo episode, maybe a dual solo episode, so you will get plenty of History of Literature goodness very soon. Today we have a great show, Jhumpa Lahiri. Part of me wants to follow a 50-year rule when it comes to literature. I'm interested in the history of literature, after all, and history doesn't really come into focus for a generation or two. But sometimes we make exceptions. Alice Munro, for example, she's so good. Why would we wait? And sometimes it's just fun to take on something that isn't all crusted over with commentary and criticism. Sometimes reading the contemporary wakes us up. I'll put today's author in both those categories. She will wind up as a part of History of Literature, I'm pretty sure. She'll be in anthologies and so on. Our children and our grandchildren will be reading her short stories, I think. And it's also refreshing to read something that's relatively current, although the story we're going to read today is now close to 20 years old. Time flies. You know how this works. Mike's going to join us in a moment, then we'll read the story, The Third and Final Continent by Jhumpa Lahiri. Then Mike will return for some analysis of the story. So let's get started. Mike Palindrome, Jhumpa Lahiri, and her story, The Third and Final Continent, after this. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup, and you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com wondery.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Okay, here we go. Mike, our old friend, welcome back to the History of Literature.
Thanks, Jack.
So our author today is Jhumpa Lahiri, who I think is one of the most highly respected authors in the world, I'd say. She's been a strong presence on the literary scene ever since her Pulitzer Prize-winning story collection Interpreter of Maladies came out in 1999. We're going to be looking at the final story in that collection, The Third and Final Continent. Mike, this one was your idea. What led you to choose this story?
Well, my wife recommended the collection to me almost 20 years ago when it was first published. And this story was her favorite and mine also. And I've reread it from time to time. So I always think of it as a good introduction to her. So.
Okay. And where would you fit Jhumpa Lahiri into, I don't know if it's too early to say the history of literature, but maybe let's say contemporary literature.
I kind of like the way she's managed her exposure, I guess.
Not you know, a whole lot of books.
Yeah, and she moved to Italy. I don't know if she's back, but I think she was living in Italy for a long time with her Greek husband and taught herself Italian.
At one point, I think she wrote a book in Italian. Yeah,
yeah,
she actually declared that she was only going to write in Italian, that she was done writing in English.
Oh, I hadn't heard that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it, you know, I like a lot of things that she represents, this kind of like pan literature, this idea that, you know, she's not an American or an Indian writer. But she's kind of all over the map, and she says as much, like her father, and when we talk about the story, you know, you'll see some parallels with her father. Her father immigrated from India to the UK, was in the UK briefly, and then moved to the US. So. But I just like her attitude. I feel like she hasn't let herself be used or made these big statements like someone like Dale Peck or, I don't know, other writers who basically have said, like, let me use the media a little bit. And it's kind of a tough battle using the media without being used.
Yeah. Yeah. She's been a little bit reclusive as far as that goes. I mean, she hasn't disappeared, but she seems to be taking things on her own terms.
Yeah, and it's funny because I went to see her read many, many years ago, and she just never showed up.
Oh.
And the bar owner said, you know, he knows her really well, and she never even called, and I can just, you know, I'll have a drink with her later and figure out what happened.
Yeah.
It was a packed bar. We were all waiting for her to show up.
Well, I wanted to go back to something that you mentioned earlier about her global exposure or project, I guess you'd say, that she's a little bit, she's not exactly from one place or another, and she makes the most of that in her fiction. I have this quote from her, which I think kind of expresses that beautifully. She says, "When I first started writing, I was not conscious that my subject was the Indian American experience. What drew me to my craft was the desire to force the two worlds I occupied to mingle on the page, as I was not brave enough or mature enough to allow in life." So it really seems like she knew she had these deep roots, these deep ties, and this almost like a second self, you know, or two separate selves. And she struggled with combining those in real life in a way, as I think a lot of people do. And so she explored it in her fiction in a way that has really resonated with people.
She's super smart, and she's very aware of the way you can unintentionally offend and unintentionally get boxed in. She never lets herself get boxed in. And yeah, there's just so much that I feel like she could be like a really great diplomat.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's where she's headed. I mean, She served on a few committees. I think she was, what, in the Pan American?
Right. I'll just throw this out there. Sometimes I think that isn't this where diversity is heading? This, maybe not necessarily a lot of race mixing, but just this kind of fluid idea of race. And nationality and ethnicity. Like, isn't this hopefully where we're heading?
Mm. Okay, well, let me tell a little bit about the author, and then we'll touch on the story, and then we will hear the story, and then we'll come back with our analysis. Jhumpa Lahiri was born in 1967 in London, England, the daughter of Bengali Indian immigrants. She moved to the United States when she was 2 and grew up in Rhode Island. She went to Boston University, where she studied literature and creative writing, and eventually wound up getting a PhD in Renaissance studies. And she has been, as we've already discussed, an incredibly successful writer, interpreter of melodies, was an Oprah selection, and it sold 15 million copies worldwide. It was just incredible for a story collection of literary fiction. It also received the Pulitzer Prize, which was only the 7th time that a story collection had won the award. Can you name the other 6?
No, but I love the story when she told her father that she had won the Pulitzer. His reaction was, you did?
I could only name one of the other 6, which was the collected stories of John Cheever. I remember hearing I remember seeing that on my copy of that, the Pulitzer sticker. Some others were collected stories of Catherine Ann Porter, collected stories of Jean Stafford. I mean, collected stories, you can kind of see where that rises to the level of a Pulitzer committee, that it's this 20 or 30 year compilation of somebody who has really been a name for a while. And for her to win it, just with her debut collection of stories, a couple of them had been in the New Yorker, but she really wasn't that prominent. Was quite an achievement to be recognized by the Pulitzer Committee that way. She has since published another short story collection called Unaccustomed Earth, and several successful novels, a couple, including The Namesake and The Lowland. And she has one, as you mentioned, that was written in Italian that I think either has been translated or is about to be translated into English. She currently lives in Rome, as far as I could tell, although she's also a professor at Princeton. And as I mentioned, she's declared that she now writes only in Italian. She also does some essay writing and writes about food. So the story we're going to hear is like many of Lahiri's earliest works, which explored the world of first-generation Indian-American immigrants. So, Mike, anything else we should talk about before we hear the third and final continent?
I ask listeners to try to guess Lahiri's favorite author or authors.
And last time, I think we set a project that we never finished. When we did the Fitzgerald, and we said, was there anything we should talk about before we hear? I think you said I would ask listeners to guess what other stories of Fitzgerald's this story makes me think of. And then we never gave the answer.
Oh, I sort of did. I Tender as the Night.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's hear Jhumpa Lahiri's story, The Third and Final Continent, and then we will be back to talk about the story.
Sounds good.
The Third and Final Continent by Jhumpa Lahiri. I left India in 1964 with a certificate in commerce and the equivalent in those days of $10 to my name. For 3 weeks, I sailed on the SS Roma, an Italian cargo vessel, in a cabin next to the ship's engine, across the Arabian Sea, the Red Sea, the Mediterranean, and finally to England. I lived in London in Finsbury Park, in a house occupied entirely by penniless Bengali bachelors like myself, at least a dozen and sometimes more, all struggling to educate and establish ourselves abroad. I attended lectures at LSE and worked at the university library to get by. We lived 3 or 4 to a room, shared a single icy toilet, and took turns cooking pots of egg curry, which we ate with our hands on a table covered with newspapers. Apart from our jobs, we had few responsibilities. On weekends, we lounged barefoot in drawstring pajamas, drinking tea and smoking Rothmans, or set out to watch cricket at Lord's. Some weekends, the house was crammed with still more Bengalis to whom we had introduced ourselves at the greengrocer or on the tube, and we made yet more egg curry and played Mukesh on a Grundig reel-to-reel and soaked our dirty dishes in the bathtub. Every now and then, someone in the house moved out to live with a woman whom his family back in Calcutta had determined he was to wed. In 1969, when I was 36 years old, my own marriage was arranged. Around the same time, I was offered a full-time job in America in the processing department of a library at MIT. The salary was generous enough to support a wife, and I was honored to be hired by a world-famous university, and so I obtained a green card and prepared to travel farther still. By then, I had enough money to go by plane. I flew first to Calcutta to attend my wedding, and a week later to Boston to begin my new job. During the flight, I read The Student Guide to North America, for although I was no longer a student, I was on a budget all the same. I learned that Americans drove on the right side of the road, not the left, and that they called a lift an elevator and an engaged phone busy. The pace of life in North America is different from Britain, as you will soon discover, the guidebook informed me. Everybody feels he must get to the top. Don't expect an English cup of tea. As the plane began its descent over Boston Harbor, the pilot announced the weather and the time, and that President Nixon had declared a national holiday. Two American men had landed on the moon. Several passengers cheered. "God bless America," one of them hollered. Across the aisle, I saw a woman praying. I spent my first night at the YMCA in Central Square, Cambridge, an inexpensive accommodation recommended by my guidebook, which was within walking distance of MIT. The room contained a cot, a desk, and a small wooden cross on one wall. A sign on the door said that cooking was strictly forbidden. A bare window overlooked Massachusetts Avenue. Car horns, shrill and prolonged, blared one after another. Sirens and flashing lights heralded endless emergencies, and a succession of buses rumbled past, their doors opening and closing with a powerful hiss throughout the night. The noise was constantly distracting, at times suffocating. I felt it deep in my ribs, just as I had felt the furious drone of the engine on the SS Roma. But there was no ship's deck to escape to, no glittering ocean to thrill my soul, no breeze to cool my face, no one to talk to. I was too tired to pace the gloomy corridors of the YMCA in my pajamas. Instead, I sat at the desk and stared out the window. In the morning, I reported to my job at the Dewey Library, a beige, fort-like building by Memorial Drive. I also opened a bank account, rented a post office box, and bought a plastic bowl and a spoon. I went to a supermarket called Purity Supreme, wandering up and down the aisles, comparing prices with those in England. In the end, I bought a carton of milk and a box of cornflakes. This was my first meal in America. Even the simple chore of buying milk was new to me. In London, we'd had bottles delivered each morning to our door. In a week, I had adjusted, more or less. I ate cornflakes and milk morning and night and bought some bananas for variety, slicing them into the bowl with the edge of my spoon. I left my carton of milk on the shaded part of the windowsill, as I had seen other residents at the YMCA do. To pass the time in the evenings, I read the Boston Globe downstairs in a spacious room with stained glass windows. I read every article and advertisement so that I would grow familiar with things, and when my eyes grew tired, I slept. Only, I did not sleep well. Each night I had to keep the window wide open. It was the only source of air in the stifling room, and the noise was intolerable. I would lie on the cot with my fingers pressed into my ears, but when I drifted off to sleep, my hands fell away, and the noise of the traffic would wake me up again. Pigeon feathers drifted onto the windowsill, and one evening, when I poured milk over my cornflakes, I saw that it had soured. Nevertheless, I resolved to stay at the YMCA for 6 weeks until my wife's passport and green card were ready. Once she arrived, I would have to rent a proper apartment, and from time to time I studied the classified section of the newspaper or stopped in at the housing office at MIT during my lunch break to see what was available. It was in this manner that I discovered a room for immediate occupancy in a house on a quiet street, the listing said, for $8 per week. I dialed the number from a pay telephone, sorting through the coins with which I was still unfamiliar, smaller and lighter than shillings, heavier and brighter than paisas. "Who is speaking?" a woman demanded. Her voice was bold and clamorous. "Yes, good afternoon, madam. I am calling about the room for rent." "Harvard or Tech?" "I beg your pardon? Are you from Harvard or Tech?" Gathering that Tech referred to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, I replied, "I work at Dewey Library," adding tentatively, "at Tech. I only rent rooms to boys from Harvard or Tech." "Yes, madam." I was given an address and an appointment for 7 o'clock that evening. 30 minutes before the hour, I set out, my guidebook in my pocket, my breath fresh with Listerine. I turned down a street shaded with trees, perpendicular to Massachusetts Avenue. In spite of the heat, I wore a coat and tie, regarding the event as I would any other interview. I had never lived in the home of a person who was not Indian. The house, surrounded by a chain-link fence, was off-white with dark brown trim, with a tangle of forsythia bushes plastered against its front and sides. When I pressed the bell, the woman with whom I had spoken on the phone hollered from what seemed to be just the other side of the door, "1 minute, please." Several minutes later, the door was opened by a tiny, extremely old woman. A mass of snowy hair was arranged like a small sack on top of her head. As I stepped into the house, she sat down on a wooden bench, positioned at the bottom of a narrow, carpeted staircase. Once she was settled on the bench, in a small pool of light, she peered up at me, giving me her undivided attention. She wore a long black skirt that spread like a stiff tent to the floor, and a starched white shirt edged with ruffles at the throat and cuffs. Her hands, folded together in her lap, had long, pallid fingers, with swollen knuckles and tough yellow nails. Age had battered her features so that she almost resembled a man, with sharp, shrunken eyes and prominent creases on either side of her nose. Her lips, chapped and faded, had nearly disappeared, and her eyebrows were missing altogether. Nevertheless, she looked fierce. "Lock up," she commanded. She shouted, even though I stood only a few feet away. "Fasten the chain and firmly press that button on the knob. This is the first thing you shall do when you enter. Is that clear?" I locked the door as directed and examined the house. Next to the bench was a small round table, its legs fully concealed, much like the woman's, by a skirt of lace. The table held a lamp, a transistor radio, a leather change purse with a silver clasp, and a telephone. A thick wooden cane was propped against one side. There was a parlor to my right, lined with bookcases and filled with shabby, claw-footed furniture. In the corner of the parlor, I saw a grand piano with its top down, piled with papers. The piano's bench was missing. It seemed to be the one on which the woman was sitting. Somewhere in the house, a clock chimed 7 times. "You're punctual," the woman proclaimed. "I expect you shall be so with the rent." "I have a letter, madam." In my jacket pocket was a letter from MIT confirming my employment, which I had brought along to prove that I was indeed from Tech. She stared at the letter, then handed it back to me carefully, gripping it with her fingers as if it were a plate heaped with food. She did not wear glasses, and I wondered if she'd read a word of it. "The last boy was always late. Still owes me $8. Harvard boys aren't what they used to be. Only Harvard and Tech in this house. How's Tech, boy?"
"It is very well."
"You checked the lock?"
"Yes, madam."
She unclasped her fingers, slapped the space beside her on the bench with one hand, and told me to sit down. For a moment, she was silent. Then she intoned,
as if she alone possessed this knowledge. There is an American flag on the moon. Yes, madam. Until then, I had not thought very much about the moonshot. It was in the newspaper, of course, article upon article. The astronauts had landed on the shores of the Sea of Tranquility, I had read, traveling farther than anyone in the history of civilization. For a few hours, they explored the moon's surface. They gathered rocks in their pockets, described their surroundings, a magnificent desolation, according to one astronaut, spoke by phone to the president, and planted a flag in lunar soil. The voyage was hailed as man's most awesome achievement. The woman bellowed, "A flag on the moon, boy! I heard it on the radio. Isn't that splendid?" "Yes, madam." But she was not satisfied with my reply. Instead, she commanded, "Say splendid." I was both baffled and somewhat insulted by the request. It reminded me of the way I was taught multiplication tables as a child. Repeating after the master, sitting cross-legged on the floor of my one-room Tollygung school. It also reminded me of my wedding, when I had repeated endless Sanskrit verses after the priest, verses I barely understood, which joined me to my wife. I said nothing.
"Say splendid," the woman bellowed once again.
"Splendid," I murmured. I had to repeat the word a second time, at the top of my lungs, so she could hear. I was reluctant to raise my voice to an elderly woman, but she did not appear to be offended. If anything, the reply pleased her, because her next command was,
"Go see the room."
I rose from the bench and mounted the narrow staircase. There were five doors, two on either side of an equally narrow hallway, and one at the opposite end. Only one door was open. The room contained a twin bed under a sloping ceiling, a brown oval rug, a basin with an exposed pipe, and a chest of drawers. One door led to a closet, another to a toilet and a tub. The window was open. Net curtains stirred in the breeze. I lifted them away and inspected the view. A small backyard with a few fruit trees and an empty clothesline. I was satisfied. When I returned to the foyer, the woman picked up the leather change purse on the table, opened the clasp, fished about with her fingers, and produced a key on a thin wire hoop. She informed me that there was a kitchen at the back of the house, accessible through the parlor. I was welcome to use the stove as long as I left it as I found it. Sheets and towels were provided, but keeping them clean was my own responsibility. The rent was due Friday mornings on the ledge above the piano keys. And no lady visitors. "I am a married man, madam." It was the first time I had announced this fact to anyone, but she had not heard.
"No lady visitors," she insisted.
She introduced herself as Mrs. Croft. My wife's name was Mala. The marriage had been arranged by my older brother and his wife. I regarded the proposition with neither objection nor enthusiasm. It was a duty expected of me, as it was expected of every man. She was the daughter of a school teacher in Bellagata. I was told that she could cook, knit, embroider, sketch landscapes, and recite poems by Tagore, but these talents could not make up for the fact that she did not possess a fair complexion, and so a string of men had rejected her to her face. She was 27, an age when her parents had begun to fear that she would never marry, and so they were willing to ship their only child halfway across the world in order to save her from spinsterhood. For 5 nights, we shared a bed. Each of those nights, after applying cold cream and braiding her hair, she turned from me and wept. She missed her parents. Although I would be leaving the country in a few days, custom dictated that she was now a part of my household, and for the next 6 weeks, she was to live with my brother and his wife, cooking, cleaning, serving tea and sweets to guests. I did nothing to console her. I lay on my own side of the bed, reading my guidebook by flashlight. At times, I thought of the tiny room on the other side of the wall, which had belonged to my mother. Now the room was practically empty. The wooden pallet on which she'd once slept was piled with trunks and old bedding. Nearly 6 years ago, before leaving for London, I had watched her die on that bed, had found her playing with her excrement in her final days. Before we cremated her, I had cleaned each of her fingernails with a hairpin, and then, because my brother could not bear it, I had assumed the role of eldest son and had touched the flame to her temple to release her tormented soul to heaven. The next morning, I moved into Mrs. Croft's house. When I unlocked the door, I saw that she was sitting on the piano bench on the same side as the previous evening. She wore the same black skirt, the same starched white blouse, and had her hands folded together the same way in her lap. She looked so much the same that I wondered if she'd spent the whole night on the bench. I put my suitcase upstairs and then headed off to work. That evening when I came home from the university, she was still there.
"Sit down, boy."
She slapped the space beside her. I perched on the bench. I had a bag of groceries with me, more milk, more cornflakes, and more bananas, for my inspection of the kitchen earlier in the day had revealed no spare pots or pans. There were only two saucepans in the refrigerator, both containing some orange broth, and a copper kettle on the stove.
"Good evening, madam."
She asked me if I had checked the lock. I told her I had. For a moment, she was silent. Then suddenly she declared, with the equal measures of disbelief and delight as the night before,
"There's an American flag on the moon, boy."
"Yes, madam."
"A flag on the moon. Isn't that splendid?"
I nodded, dreading what I knew was coming. "Yes, madam."
"Say splendid."
This time I paused, looking to either side in case someone was there to overhear me, though I knew perfectly well that the house was empty. I felt like an idiot, but it was a small enough thing to ask.
"Splendid!"
I cried out. Within days, it became part of our routine. In the mornings when I left for the library, Mrs. Croft was either hidden away in her bedroom, on the other side of the staircase, or sitting on the bench, oblivious of my presence, listening to the news or classical music on the radio. But each evening when I returned, the same thing happened. She slapped the bench, ordered me to sit down, declared that there was a flag on the moon, and declared that it was splendid. I said it was splendid too, and then we sat in silence. As awkward as it was, and as endless as it felt to me then, the nightly encounter lasted only about 10 minutes. Inevitably, she would drift off to sleep, her head falling abruptly toward her chest, leaving me free to retire to my room. By then, of course, there was no flag standing on the moon. The astronauts, I read in the paper, had seen it fall before they flew back to Earth. But I did not have the heart to tell her. Friday morning, when my first week's rent was due, I went to the piano in the parlor to place my money on the ledge. The piano keys were dull and discolored. When I pressed one, it made no sound at all. I had put $8 bills in an envelope and written Mrs. Croft's name on the front of it. I was not in the habit of leaving money unmarked and unattended. From where I stood, I could see the profile of her tent-shaped skirt in the hall. It seemed unnecessary to make her get up and walk all the way to the piano. I never saw her walking about and assumed, from the cane propped against the round table, that she did so with difficulty. When I approached the bench, she peered up at me and demanded,
"What is your business?"
"The rent, madam."
"On the ledge above the piano keys."
"I have it here." I extended the envelope toward her, but her fingers, folded together in her lap, did not budge. I bowed slightly and lowered the envelope so that it hovered just above her hands. After a moment, she accepted it and nodded her head. That night when I came home, she did not slap the bench, but out of habit, I sat beside her as usual. She asked me if I had checked the lock, but she mentioned nothing about the flag on the moon. Instead, she said,
"It was very kind of you."
"I beg your pardon, madam?"
"Very kind of you."
She was still holding the envelope in her hands. On Sunday, there was a knock on my door, An elderly woman introduced herself. She was Mrs. Croft's daughter, Helen. She walked into the room and looked at each of the walls as if for signs of change, glancing at the shirts that hung in the closet, the neckties draped over the doorknob, the box of cornflakes on the chest of drawers, the dirty bowl and spoon in the basin. She was short and thick-waisted, with cropped silver hair and bright pink lipstick. She wore a sleeveless summer dress, a necklace of white plastic beads, and spectacles on a chain that hung like a swing against her chest. The backs of her legs were mapped with dark blue veins, and her upper arms sagged like the flesh of a roasted eggplant. She told me she lived in Arlington, a town farther up Massachusetts Avenue. "I come once a week to bring Mother groceries. Has she sent you packing yet?" "It is very well, madam." "Some of the boys run screaming, but I think she likes you. You're the first boarder she's ever referred to as a gentleman." She looked at me, noticing my bare feet. I still felt strange wearing shoes indoors and always removed them before entering my room. "Are you new to Boston?"
"New to America, madam."
"From?" She raised her eyebrows.
"I am from Calcutta, India."
"Is that right? We had a Brazilian fellow about a year ago. You'll find Cambridge is a very international city."
I nodded and began to wonder how long our conversation would last. But at that moment, we heard Mrs. Croft's electrifying voice rising up the stairs.
"You are to come downstairs immediately."
"What is it?"
Helen cried back.
"Immediately." I put on my shoes. Helen sighed. I followed Helen down the staircase. She seemed to be in no hurry and complained at one point that she had a bad knee.
"Have you been walking without your cane?"
Helen called out.
"You know you're not supposed to walk without that cane."
She paused, resting her hand on the banister, and looked back at me. "She slips sometimes." For the first time, Mrs. Croft seemed vulnerable. I pictured her on the floor in front of the bench, flat on her back, staring at the ceiling, her feet pointing in opposite directions. But when we reached the bottom of the staircase, she was sitting there as usual, her hands folded together in her lap. Two grocery bags were at her feet. She did not slap the bench or ask us to sit down. She glared.
"What is it, Mother?"
"It's improper."
"What's improper?"
"It is improper for a lady and gentleman who are not married to one another to hold a private conversation without a chaperone."
Helen said she was 68 years old enough to be my mother, but Mrs. Croft insisted that Helen and I speak to each other downstairs, in the parlor. She added that it was also improper for a lady of Helen's station to reveal her age and to wear a dress so high above the ankle.
"For your information, Mother, it's 1969. What would you do if you actually left the house one day and saw a girl in a miniskirt?"
Mrs. Croft sniffed.
"I'd have her arrested."
Helen shook her head and picked up one of the grocery bags. I picked up the other one and followed her through the parlor and into the kitchen. The bags were filled with cans of soup, which Helen opened up one by one with a few cranks of a can opener. She tossed the old soup into the sink, rinsed the saucepans under the tap, filled them with soup from the newly opened cans, and put them back in the refrigerator.
"A few years ago, she could still open the cans herself," Helen said. "She hates that I do it for her now, but the piano killed her hands."
She put on her spectacles, glanced at the cupboards, and spotted my tea bags.
"Shall we have a cup?"
I filled the kettle on the stove.
"I beg your pardon, madam. The piano?"
"She used to give lessons for 40 years. It was how she raised us after my father died." Helen put her hands on her hips, staring at the open refrigerator. She reached into the back, pulled out a wrapped stick of butter, frowned, and tossed it into the garbage.
"That ought to do it," she said, and put the unopened cans of soup in the cupboard.
I sat at the table and watched as Helen washed the dirty dishes, tied up the garbage bag, and poured boiling water into two cups.
She handed one to me without milk and sat down at the table.
"Excuse me, madam, but is it enough?"
Helen took a sip of her tea. Her lipstick left a smiling pink stain on the rim of the cup.
"Is what enough?"
"The soup in the pans. Is it enough food for Mrs. Croft?"
"She won't eat anything else. She stopped eating solids after she turned 100. That was, let's see, 3 years ago."
I was mortified. I had assumed Mrs. Croft was in her 80s, perhaps as old as 90. I had never known a person who had lived for over a century. That this person was a widow who lived alone mortified me further still. Widowhood had driven my own mother insane. My father, who worked as a clerk at the General Post Office of Calcutta, died of encephalitis when I was 16. My mother refused to adjust to life without him. Instead, she sank deeper into a world of darkness from which neither I, nor my brother, nor concerned relatives, nor psychiatric clinics on Rajbahari Avenue could save her. What pained me most was to see her so unguarded, to hear her burp after meals or expel gas in front of company without the slightest embarrassment. After my father's death, my brother abandoned his schooling and began to work in the jute mill he would eventually manage in order to keep the household running. And so it was my job to sit by my mother's feet and study for my exams as she counted and recounted the bracelets on her arm as if they were the beads of an abacus. We tried to keep an eye on her. Once she had wandered half-naked to the tram depot before we were able to bring her inside again.
"I am happy to warm Mrs. Croft's soup in the evenings," I suggested. "It is no trouble."
Helen looked at her watch, stood up, and poured the rest of her tea into the sink.
"I wouldn't if I were you. That's the sort of thing that would kill her altogether."
That evening, when Helen had gone and Mrs. Croft and I were alone again, I began to worry. Now that I knew how very old she was, I worried that something would happen to her in the middle of the night or when I was out during the day. As vigorous as her voice was, and imperious as she seemed, I knew that even a scratch or a cough could kill a person that old. Each day she lived, I knew, was something of a miracle. Helen didn't seem concerned. She came and went, bringing soup for Mrs. Croft, one Sunday after the next. In this manner, the 6 weeks of that summer passed. I came home each evening after my hours at the library and spent a few minutes on the piano bench with Mrs. Croft. Some evenings I sat beside her long after she had drifted off to sleep, still in awe of how many years she had spent on this earth. At times I tried to picture the world she had been born into in 1866, a world, I imagined, filled with women in long black skirts and chaste conversations in the parlor. Now, when I looked at her hands with their swollen knuckles folded together in her lap, I imagined them smooth and slim, striking the piano keys. At times I came downstairs before going to sleep to make sure she was sitting upright on the bench or was safe in her bedroom. On Fridays, I put the rent in her hands. There was nothing I could do for her beyond these simple gestures. I was not her son, and apart from those $8, I owed her nothing. At the end of August, Mala's passport and green card were ready. I received a telegram with her flight information. My brother's house in Calcutta had no telephone. Around that time, I also received a letter from her, written only a few days after we had parted. There was no salutation. Addressing me by name would have assumed an intimacy we had not yet discovered. It contained only a few lines. "I write in English in preparation for the journey. Here I am very much lonely. I sit very cold there. Is there snow? Yours, Mala." I was not touched by her words. We had spent only a handful of days in each other's company, and yet we were bound together. For 6 weeks, she had worn an iron bangle on her wrist and applied vermilion powder to the part in her hair to signify to the world that she was a bride. In those 6 weeks, I regarded her arrival as I would the arrival of a coming month or season, something inevitable, but meaningless at the time. So little did I know her that while details of her face sometimes rose to my memory, I could not conjure up the whole of it. A few days after receiving the letter, as I was walking to work in the morning, I saw an Indian woman on Massachusetts Avenue, wearing a sari with its free end, nearly dragging on the footpath and pushing a child in a stroller. An American woman with a small black dog on a leash was walking to one side of her. Suddenly, the dog began barking. I watched as the Indian woman, startled, stopped in her path, at which point the dog leaped up and seized the end of the sari between its teeth. The American woman scolded the dog, appeared to apologize, and walked quickly away, leaving the Indian woman to fix her sari and quiet her crying child. She did not see me standing there, and eventually she continued on her way. Such a mishap, I realized that morning, would soon be my concern. It was my duty to take care of Mala, to welcome her and protect her. I would have to buy her her first pair of snow boots, her first winter coat. I would have to tell her which streets to avoid, which way the traffic came, tell her to wear her sari so that the free end did not drag on the footpath. A 5-mile separation from her parents, I recalled with some irritation, had caused her to weep. Unlike Mala, I was used to it all by then, used to the cornflakes and milk, used to Helen's visits, used to sitting on the bench with Mrs. Croft. The only thing I was not used to was Mala. Nevertheless, I did what I had to do. I went to the housing office at MIT and found a furnished apartment a few blocks away, with a double bed and a private kitchen and bath, for $40 a week. One last Friday, I handed Mrs. Croft $8 bills in an envelope, brought my suitcase downstairs, and informed her that I was moving. She put my key into her change purse. The last thing she asked me to do was hand her the cane propped against the table so that she could walk to the door and lock it behind me. "Goodbye, then," she said, and retreated back into the house. I did not expect any display of emotion, but I was disappointed all the same. I was only a boarder, a man who paid her a bit of money and passed in and out of her home for 6 weeks. Compared with a century, it was no time at all. At the airport, I recognized Mala immediately. The free end of her sari did not drag on the floor, but was draped in a sign of bridal modesty over her head, just as it had draped my mother until the day my father died. Her thin brown arms were stacked with gold bracelets, a small red circle was painted on her forehead, and the edges of her feet were tinted with a decorative red dye. I did not embrace her, or kiss her, or take her hand. Instead, I asked her, speaking Bengali for the first time in America, if she was hungry. She hesitated, then nodded yes. I told her I had prepared some egg curry at home. "What did they give you to eat on the plane?" "I didn't eat." "All the way from Calcutta?" "The menu said oxtail soup." "But surely there were other items." The thought of eating an ox's tail made me lose my appetite. When we arrived home, Mala opened up one of her suitcases and presented me with 2 pullover sweaters, both made with bright blue wool, which she had knitted in the course of our separation, one with a V-neck, the other covered with cables. I tried them on. Both were tight under the arms. She had also brought me 2 new pairs of drawstring pajamas, a letter from my brother, and a packet of loose Darjeeling tea. I had no present for her apart from the egg curry. We sat at a bare table, staring at our plates. We ate with our hands, another thing I had not yet done in America. "The house is nice," she said. "Also, the egg curry." With her left hand, she held the end of her sari to her chest so it would not slip off her head. "I don't know many recipes." She nodded, peeling the skin off each of her potatoes before eating them. At one point, the sari slipped to her shoulders. She readjusted it at once. "There's no need to cover your head," I said. "I don't mind. It doesn't matter here." She kept it covered anyway. I waited to get used to her presence at my side at my table and in my bed, but a week later we were still strangers. I still was not used to coming home to an apartment that smelled of steamed rice and finding that the basin in the bathroom was always wiped clean. Our two toothbrushes lying side by side, a cake of Pears soap residing in the soap dish. I was not used to the fragrance of the coconut oil she rubbed every other night into her scalp, or the delicate sound her bracelets made as she moved about the apartment. In the mornings, she was always awake before I was. The first morning when I came into the kitchen, she had heated up the leftovers and set a plate with a spoonful of salt on its edge, assuming I would eat rice for breakfast, as most Bengali husbands did. I told her cereal would do, and the next morning when I came into the kitchen, she had already poured the cornflakes into my bowl. One morning, she walked with me to MIT, where I gave her a short tour of the campus. The next morning before I left for work, she asked me for a few dollars. I parted with them reluctantly, but I knew that this, too, was now normal. When I came home from work, there was a potato peeler in the kitchen drawer, and a tablecloth on the table, and chicken curry made with fresh garlic and ginger on the stove. After dinner, I read the newspaper while Mala sat at the kitchen table, working on a cardigan for herself with more of the blue wool, or writing letters home. On Friday, I suggested going out. Mala set down her knitting and disappeared into the bathroom. When she emerged, I regretted the suggestion. She had put on a silk sari and extra bracelets and coiled her hair with a flattering side part on top of her head. She was prepared as if for a party, or at the very least for the cinema, but I had no such destination in mind. The evening was balmy. We walked several blocks down Massachusetts Avenue, looking into the windows of restaurants and shops. Then, without thinking, I led her down the quiet street where for so many nights I had walked alone. "This is where I lived before you came," I said, stopping at Mrs. Croft's chain-link fence. "In such a big house?" "I had a small room upstairs, at the back." "Who else lives there?" "A very old woman."
"With her family?"
"Alone."
"But who takes care of her?"
I opened the gate. "For the most part, she takes care of herself." I wondered if Mrs. Croft would remember me. I wondered if she had a new boarder to sit with her each evening. When I pressed the bell, I expected the same long wait as that day of our first meeting, when I did not have a key. But this time, the door was opened almost immediately by Helen. Mrs. Croft was not sitting on the bench. The bench was gone.
"Hello there," Helen said, smiling with her bright pink lips at Mala. "Mother's in the parlor. Will you be visiting a while?"
"As you wish, madam."
"Then I think I'll run to the store, if you don't mind. She had a little accident. We can't leave her alone these days, not even for a minute."
I locked the door after Helen and walked into the parlor. Mrs. Croft was lying flat on her back, her head on a peach-colored cushion, a thin white quilt spread over her body. Her hands were folded together on her chest. When she saw me, she pointed at the sofa and told me to sit down. I took my place as directed, but Mala wandered over to the piano and sat on the bench, which was now positioned where it belonged.
"I broke my hip,"
Mrs. Croft announced, as if no time had passed.
"Oh dear, madam. I fell off the bench."
"I am so sorry, madam.
It was the middle of the night. Do you know what I did, boy?"
I shook my head.
"I called the police."
She stared up at the ceiling and grinned sedately, exposing a crowded row of long gray teeth.
"What do you say to that, boy?"
As stunned as I was, I knew what I had to say. With no hesitation at all, I cried out,
"Splendid!"
Mala laughed then. Her voice was full of kindness, her eyes bright with amusement. I had never heard her laugh before, and it was loud enough so that Mrs. Croft heard too. She turned to Mala and glared.
"Who is she, boy?"
"She is my wife, madam." Mrs. Croft pressed her head at an angle against the cushion to get a better look.
"Can you play the piano?"
"No, madam," Mala replied.
"Then stand up."
Mala rose to her feet, adjusting the end of her sari over her head and holding it to her chest, and for the first time since her arrival, I felt sympathy. I remembered my first days in London, learning how to take the tube to Russell Square, riding an escalator for the first time, unable to understand that when the man cried, "Piper," it meant paper, unable to decipher for a whole year that the conductor said, "Mind the gap," as the train pulled away from each station. Like me, Mala had traveled far from home, not knowing where she was going or what she would find, for no reason other than to be my wife. As strange as it seemed, I knew in my heart that one day her death would affect me, and stranger still, that mine would affect her. I wanted somehow to explain this to Mrs. Croft, who was still scrutinizing Mala from top to toe with what seemed to be placid disdain. I wondered if Mrs. Croft had ever seen a woman in a sari with a dot painted on her forehead and bracelets stacked on her wrists. I wondered what she would object to. I wondered if she could see the red dye still vivid on Mala's feet, all but obscured by the bottom edge of her sari. At last, Mrs. Croft declared, with the equal measures of disbelief and delight I knew well, "She is a perfect lady." Now it was I who laughed. I did so quietly, and Mrs. Croft did not hear me. But Mala had heard, and for the first time, we looked at each other and smiled. I like to think of that moment in Mrs. Croft's parlor as the moment when the distance between Mala and me began to lessen. Although we were not yet fully in love, I like to think of the months that followed as a honeymoon of sorts. Together, we explored the city and met other Bengalis, some of whom are still friends today. We discovered that a man named Bill sold fresh fish on Prospect Street, and that a shop in Harvard Square called Cardulo's sold bay leaves and cloves. In the evenings, we walked to the Charles River to watch sailboats drift across the water, or had ice cream cones in Harvard Yard. We bought a camera with which to document our life together, and I took pictures of her posing in front of the Prudential Building so that she could send them to her parents. At night, we kissed, shy at first, but quickly bold, and discovered pleasure and solace in each other's arms. I told her about my voyage on the SS Roma and about Finsbury Park and the YMCA and my evenings on the bench with Mrs. Croft. When I told her stories about my mother, she wept. It was Mala who consoled me. When reading the Globe one evening, I came across Mrs. Croft's obituary. I had not thought of her in several months. By then, those 6 weeks of the summer were already a remote interlude in my past. But when I learned of her death, I was stricken, so much so that when Mala looked up from her knitting, she found me staring at the wall, unable to speak. Mrs. Croft's was the first death I mourned in America, for hers was the first life I had admired. She had left this world at last, ancient and alone, never to return. As for me, I have not strayed much farther. Mala and I live in a town about 20 miles from Boston, on a tree-lined street, much like Mrs. Croft's, in a house we own with room for guests, and a garden that saves us from buying tomatoes in summer. We are American citizens now, so that we can collect Social Security when it is time. Though we visit Calcutta every few years, we have decided to grow old here. I work in a small college library. We have a son who attends Harvard University. Mala no longer drapes the end of her sari over her head or weeps at night for her parents, but occasionally she weeps for our son. So we drive to Cambridge to visit him, or bring him home for a weekend so that he can eat rice with us with his hands and speak in Bengali, things we sometimes worry he will no longer do after we die. Whenever we make that drive, I always take Massachusetts Avenue, in spite of the traffic. I barely recognize the buildings now, but each time I am there, I return instantly to those 6 weeks as if they were only the other day, and I slow down and point to Mrs. Croft Street, saying to my son, "Here was my first home in America, where I lived with a woman who was 103. Remember, Mala says and smiles, amazed, as I am, that there was ever a time that we were strangers. My son always expresses his astonishment, not at Mrs. Croft's age, but at how little I paid in rent, a fact nearly as inconceivable to him as a flag on the moon was to a woman born in 1866. In my son's eyes, I see the ambition that had first hurled me across the world. In a few years, he will graduate and pave his own way, alone and unprotected. But I remind myself that he has a father who is still living, a mother who is happy and strong. Whenever he is discouraged, I tell him that if I can survive on 3 continents, then there is no obstacle he cannot conquer. While the astronauts, heroes forever, spent mere hours on the moon, I have remained in this new world for nearly 30 years. I know that my achievement is quite ordinary. I am not the only man to seek his fortune far from home, and certainly I am not the first. Still, there are times I am bewildered by each mile I have traveled, each meal I have eaten, each person I have known, each room in which I have slept. As ordinary as it all appears, there are times when it is beyond my imagination.
Okay, we're back. Mike, there's one big point I want to make about the story, but before we get there, I'm curious, as a child of immigrants yourself, did this one resonate with you for that reason?
It did. You know, there's familiar tropes. Like, mm-hmm.
And our age, we should say our age is pretty similar. I mean, yeah. I'm guessing that she and her family landed on the East Coast pretty close in time to when you and your parents would have, obviously kind of coming from a different culture. But, you know, as far as what it's like in the 70s to be in the States, that's something that your parents certainly had to understand.
Yeah. So the economic struggle, the frugality, cramped housing, and then also, I think she really captures this, you know, this sticking with your own kind because nobody else really sees you, how you're anonymous in this white world. So I really love that about the story. And then the thing that drew me to the story even more was the way she uses all those familiar tropes, but then she goes off in this other direction.
What's the other direction?
I think it's this strange friendship between between the homeowner, the white elderly homeowner, and the narrator, and it's one of these like real cinematic friendships.
You mean like you're in your mind, you're casting it.
Yeah.
It's like, you're thinking like, is Helen Mirren now old enough to play? Could Judy Dench play this yet? Do we need somebody who's even older? Yeah.
I mean, it's so visual and it's so simple that they're just sitting on the piano bench every day. And it really is like just this bizarre story. It's almost like I feel like anything can happen. Like, I think the first time I read it, I was just like, oh my God, who's going to die? Like what, you know, it was just so weird the way it took off like that.
Yeah.
But then it doesn't deliver on that. I mean, that there comes a point where you realize as a reader, oh, it's not going to take me into that kind of a story.
Yeah, no, it's, I think once the narrator's wife shows up or is about to show up,
mm-hmm.
it becomes, you know, again, another kind of story.
Right.
It becomes much more about being an immigrant.
Yep. So let me get back to you. I'm interested in you and your parents. If you could imagine your way into writing a story like this one that was narrated by your parents, it seems like to me, on the one hand, you know, it's a rich source of material. I'm guessing that Jhumpa Lahiri heard a lot of these details directly from her father. Maybe there were others that she was interested in researching, or maybe she applied some of her own creativity to it. But on the other hand, it seems like it would be a really difficult task to feel like you were correctly capturing it, or maybe even to immerse yourself in that world would feel transgressive in some senses, as if you were usurping a story that wasn't yours. And I'm wondering, you know, where you would stand, if this is something you could imagine doing, or if you would shy away from it.
I think, the reality is I'm doing it now.
Oh.
In the novel I'm writing.
Okay.
I've been working on. But I think that the children of immigrants end up telling these stories over and over again to their friends or lovers or... And you kind of get better at it because you know when, you know, you can deliver laughs,
yeah.
or when you can kind of bring a conversation to a halt because it's too sad.
Mm.
You know, you have to know, what I say is you have to know when to reveal that kind of immigrant detail, because right. people don't know how to react because it seems too pat and flippant to just say like, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, that, right. that you had to go through that.
Are you talking about racist comments or having to deal with people's prejudice and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, sometimes it's not such a great conversation starter to be right.
Yeah.
And to have a message. And I think that's my problem with some immigrant fiction, is that there's too much of a social message and you get clanged over the head like an op-ed. And I personally hate op-eds. I think they're about 20 times the length that they should be.
Right. The problem I have with fiction when it does that is it feels like if you're talking to people who are reading literary fiction, who is your audience? Yep. And it feels like you're telling some of the most enlightened people available, right. Stuff that they already agree with. And so they're going to read it and applaud, and they're going to, maybe they'll praise you for the story. But on the other hand, you're telling them things that they probably already know, as far as how to think, or, you know, that, that this kind of thing can happen.
I feel that maybe 2/3 of all op-eds are directed at people who already agree with you.
Yeah. And then they want to forward it to people who disagree, and those people ignore it.
Or they forward it to people they agree that would agree with it, and then they toot back like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
As if like they've learned something, but they haven't.
I've noticed this thing on websites. There's a type of article now that they'll run on websites, and they'll say, so-and-so says something, Twitter lets him have it. You know, like Twitter fights back. And it's basically somebody says some asinine comment on Twitter, and then there's all these funny responses. On the one hand, it's kind of amusing to read and, you know, but on the other hand, it really gives a distorted view of current events. It makes it seem like somebody has been totally disgraced and shut down. And instead, all you're doing is taking, you know, 6 or 8 comments that are buried on somewhere on someone's Twitter feed in the comment section. It's meaningless, but yeah. You know, it's just sort of voyeuristic. But ultimately it really doesn't, it's not as if then that person changed his mind or ran away from his previous comment. He probably didn't even see those.
It's time wasting. It's the heavy handedness. I mean, it's just, and also it's worse than time wasting. It, you know, when someone tells me how stupid Trump is, for example, not to bring Trump in, but I tune it out and I tune that person out. I need something, you know, more interesting than this heavy handedness.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise I already know how stupid Trump is. I mean, I just don't think it needs to even be said. But I mean, you know, with immigrant fiction, it's this idea that, you know, if you work hard, I mean, for example, you'll succeed. And, you know, that's not what fiction is about, where you can telegraph what's going to happen. And it detracts from the colorfulness of a character. I mean, when I think of like V.S. Naipaul and Miguel Street, the short story collection, the characters in there are so flawed. And, you know, I feel that some immigrant fiction, they are afraid to make them flawed, you know?
Yeah, because they're trying to put forward a sort of point of view, which is that immigrants are good. They deal with a lot. They should be celebrated. And so they end up becoming a kind of, maybe not as complex as you would get in a different kind of fiction.
Yeah, I mean, and so this story, you know, there are these moments where the narrator reveals his flaws and his biases. He said his own biases. He says, you know, of his wife, that she can broider and cook, but these talents could not make up for the fact that she did not possess a fair complexion, and so a string of men had rejected her to her face. And then when she's having struggle. She's struggling fitting in. The narrator goes, I did nothing to console her. I lay on my own side of the bed, reading my guidebook by flashlight and anticipating my journeys. And it's like, damn. So he's kind of, I mean, you know, the whole idea of heroes and villains, like the narrator is clearly, I mean, I personally like anti-heroes. I mean, he's not an anti-hero, but you know, there are very rich moments where I feel sympathy for a character that's flawed.
Yeah. Well, you know, heroes and villains is interesting because it suggests that there would be some conflict. And what I was kind of coming to realize as I was reading this, it really took me back to that world of the 1990s when I was reading hundreds of these stories in the MFA world, and I was judging short story contests and, you know, just had a lot of these MFA type stories coming my way. And I mean, this is as good as it gets for a type of story like that. I'm going to call it an epiphany story where it's not really a conflict. There's no, you know, the conflict here, I guess you could say, is will I fit in? Will he fit in? It kind of moves from what looks like it might be a conflict from one to the next, but it's really just a question. The first third of it is, will I make my way in the world here in America with a new job and finding an apartment? And then it's what's going to happen with this old woman? And then it's what's going to happen with the old woman's daughter when she shows up, and what's going to happen to this trio? And then it becomes, what's going to happen when my wife shows up with this arranged marriage, and will she fit in? And then you sort of realize the whole thing is just going to be more observation and detail. And then there will come a moment where some kind of clarity is reached, or some kind of resolution, some kind of new revelation. And it's not like a decision that's being made. It's not a, well, should I do this or should I do that? with, you know, severe consequences on both sides, potentially serious, potentially mm-hmm. serious course of life events will hang in the balance. Instead, it's more, well, looking back over my life, this was a clarifying moment. Mm-hmm. For Epiphany Stories, what it really needs to have is fantastic writing.
Yeah.
Because it's almost more important what comes before than what comes after the epiphany. I mean, the epiphany is sort of the yeah. central moment, but the epiphany is usually a big letdown. It's usually something that isn't any big surprise, and it doesn't really, it seems like it changes everything, but really it just sort of states something that we all know is true about life. Like, it's full of mysteries, or you could sort of say, and that's when I realized dot, dot, dot. And the thing that comes after the dot, dot, dot is usually kind of the most boring part of the story. And the interesting part of the story is those details, like his relationship with the landlady, or, you know, the unusual things that happened to him, the really insightful details about what life is like, and just the sort of beautiful selection of details that gives you this whole picture of who he is and what it's like to be him at this time. But as far as drama goes, you know, you can't really look at it as, oh, this is the story that taught me X, if you're trying to match the epiphany to the X, because I don't think that really teaches you anything. I think it what taught me something was seeing what his life was like prior to that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like epiphany short stories.
Yeah.
So when I think of her, I kind of think of her and like James Lasdin. And I think you're right. It's like writers who are incredibly economical and emotional in the way they write, regardless of whether the story is. I don't expect much out of a short story that mm-hmm. has a heavy plot. And so I guess maybe like I just approach short stories differently. I don't expect there to be a big conflict. You know, when I think of short stories like the Raymond Carver stories, there really isn't like a payoff. It's just it's the moment to moment.
And what you're left with at the end of the story is not so much a development of the character or a kind of arc or any of the things that we expect from a novel, but you remember the situation they were in, or the particular sort of detail that happened to them along the way that really conveyed what was happening to that character.
The old lady telling him to say the word splendid. Yeah, I mean, that's right. Just, you feel his conflict, the frustration of being told by this white person
yeah.
to follow an order. But at the same time thinking, I mean, what's the harm in it? Like right. what? There's no audience. Nobody's seeing him being subservient. What's the harm? And then you realize that, you know, this elderly person, that's all there is to her day.
Yeah.
You know, and it is this, I love the way it spans beyond this period by jumping and showing the narrator and the wife having a son. And him going to Harvard. And
yeah,
because I think that's, you know, that's really the only way people can appreciate the elderly is by getting old.
Also, it jumps back in time. And we hear his backstory where his own mother has wrestled with senility and that she was sort of broken after his father had died. And so you kind of you see the resonances between his relationship with this landlady and his own feelings as a son.
One thing I'll say about immigrant fiction, certain immigrant stereotypes are absolutely true. I mean, you know, the duty to your parents, the showing deference to your parents, you know, immigrants have that. And it's interesting to see the way the narrator can't break out of it with this white person who's elderly and finds himself falling into that relationship. And then meeting the elderly white landlord's daughter is hilarious because
Yeah.
What the narrator says, when I saw how old she was, it suddenly dawned on me how old the landlord was. And then he has these great lines, like he says, you know, he obviously doesn't connect with this daughter as much as the mother. And he says, I wonder how long this conversation would last with the daughter.
Yeah. Even though you'd think that would be a relief to meet the daughter. You know, it's funny that you say that that you were reading this as emphasizing how much he couldn't break out of this relationship with this elderly woman, because the thing that struck me was almost the opposite. Because I thought, okay, what's going to happen here? And then all of a sudden the wife shows up and he leaves the apartment. And I thought what that emphasized for me was, okay, he's shown that he's a resilient guy and he's on his sort of adventure and he's open-minded and he's capable of adapting. And he adapted to this strange situation with his landlady. And he went along with it in a way that would kind of work for her and work for him. And then what it emphasized to me was, well, here's this woman who's coming, his arranged marriage, this wife he has in an arranged marriage. That's going to be permanent. That's not something that you can just say, oh, the lease is up, I'm gone, you know? And so it kind of emphasized, well, he's shown that he's adaptable, but now he's going to be adapting to something that isn't just an hour a day or something. It's going to be, and it's going to be much more intimate. So will his powers of adaptation be up to the task of an arranged marriage? But then that didn't really become the story either. There's one point where he says, what would happen if she died when I was there? And you think, here's where we're headed. You know, he comes home and he's got to call the ambulance and they come over and maybe they wonder who he is and why he knows so much about her and he doesn't really know. You know, you could see a whole story potentially unfold from that comment. And instead, it doesn't. It just moves to the next thing.
But then, and when she does die,
it's called back.
It's perfect because the reader, I think, and the narrator are aligned in feeling that you're sad that someone's dead, but you're not that sad because you really didn't know this person, you know?
And the way it's given to us is that he says she's the one, she talking about his wife, she's the one who consoled me when she read the news of the obituary. So it's almost like you said, we jumped ahead and now we see the marriage after it's settled down and settled in and showed that it had some strength to it. And then it showed that this wife had such a compassion for her husband, such empathy that she knew this would matter to him. And it was something that she noticed and brought to his attention.
Her prose is so elegant and precise, and it's really like from another century.
Mm.
I just think that, you know, the way she allows the reader in is very carefully. The story starts like, you know, I wrote like thousands of other stories. I mean, it starts with this beginning that you just think like, okay, this is, you know, a plain vanilla setup.
It's almost like my grandmother wrote her memoirs and it started almost like that.
Yeah.
My grandmother emigrated from Switzerland, but it was, I arrived on that's how she would talk about her experience. You know, I was born in this town. I arrived on the such and such boat. We stopped at Ellis Island. We did this, you know, and then we took the train to Chicago. Then we came up, you know, it was like, Jhumpa Lahiri is the prose is very beautiful and not a word is out of place and it sounds wonderful. It's almost like poetry, but it's very, it doesn't start out with a sort of killer opening line, you know, like the first time I had sex with a man for money, I was 17 and, you know, something that, or there was one rule that I had learned early in life, and from then on, I never forgot it. you're immediately grabbed and you're facing some big promise of what's to come. It's not like that at all.
Yeah. She's very aware, I feel, of her style.
Mm-hmm.
Her favorite writers are Chekhov and Thomas Hardy and Nikolai Gogol.
Mm.
Those three writers, I think, they don't exactly have fireworks in their style. It's really everything else that comes through. And I think she is a master of the way the breaks in the scenes work.
Mm.
I just think that this story really deepens, you know, when you read it again and again.
Mm.
I don't think you can read it every year. I said that it's really kind of like an old friend rather than a city. Like maybe Babylon Revisited to me is like a city. You can visit it all the time.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so we've done a bunch of these stories now. Let me go through them and you tell me whether it's one you think is a city or an old friend.
Okay.
Alice Munro, The Bear Came Over the Mountain.
That's like an old friend.
Mm, every few years.
Yeah, I don't think you can read it every year.
How about The Things They Carried?
That's a tough one. I mean, I'm going to have to go with old friend, but I think maybe that's because I've read it that way. So
proven itself as an old friend.
Yeah.
What about The Lady with the Dog?
I think that's definitely like a city.
Yeah. Yeah. That's maybe.
The movement in that is, and the lady herself, there's so much history to her.
I feel like I should be reading that one once a month. And we didn't talk about The Dead, but I've talked about that as one that I read once a year. So I'm going to say that that's a city.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I only read it for the second time last year because you told me that you read it every Christmas season. So
yeah,
I was feeling guilty. So
any others? I can't think of offhand. I know we've done other stories too, but some of them I guess we were doing for the first time. So that's not really fair. Harrison Bergeron and.
Yeah, I mean, I think certain things are surprising cities, like Lori Moore's People Like That Are the Only People Here.
Mm.
I think think that that's more like a friend, but I think it's really a city.
It's not a friend for me. That's more like a city I visited, had a horrible time, and don't want to go back to. That's the city where I was robbed, and... have bad connotations with that place. Okay. So this is good. So what else should we say about the story before we wrap things up here?
I think her humor, I would love to see her try her hand at a comic novel because I think her humor is very, very subtle. I mean, the anger when he's being told to say splendid and finally he's just like, well, what's the harm in it? Splendid. It's hilarious. And then later when she asks him something, he's like, well, there was only one thing to say. Splendid.
So I was a little surprised that you chose this because you're sort of famously on record as saying that you're not a fan of short stories because they're too short. But did this one, because it kind of portrays this whole world with the details and really gives us a slice of life at the time, is that what won you over with this one?
Partly, yes. And I think the other thing is just I went through a phase where even though I dislike short stories, I really try to read as many as I could, including many in The New Yorker. And I just started to hate certain tropes like falling snow.
Right.
And people walking around. I was just like, oh my gosh, if I go for a walk, I'm putting this down.
Leaving and walking home in the rain.
And I think it takes courage and it takes skill to try to cover, and Monroe does this beautifully, cover decades in a story.
Yeah.
I think because, you know, it can feel gimmicky if you say 6 years passed, you know.
Right.
Lahiri does that so well here that it's, and I'm wondering if we should do a story by James Lasden. Because I think he does that also well. He wrote a collection. Bertolucci fell in love with one of his short stories and made a movie out of a short story. I'm trying to remember which one.
It was Besieged.
Oh, Besieged. Right, right. He has a kind of a weird novel called The Horned Man, which I highly recommend. But anyway. But we should do another short story from that period when I was just reading short stories.
Okay. Sounds good. And in the meantime, people can definitely read The Third and Final Continent. Now, this comes at the end of the collection, Interpreter of Maladies. Do you think they should just go and read this story, or should they earn their way to it by reading the entire collection and save this one for its place at the end?
I often say jump to the best, but
jump to the best.
But this collection is so good that they should start from the beginning.
Okay, well, let's leave things there. Mike, as always, thanks for joining me on the History of Literature.
Thanks, Jack.
Going to do it for this episode of the History of Literature. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you are enjoying life wherever you are, whether you come from many generations tied to a particular place, or whether you yourself are in transit from one society to another, or whether you're somewhere in between. My thanks to Mike Palindrome, as always, for joining me. We'll be back soon, and in the meantime, as always, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.